This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thanks very much for choosing to listen to this. I'm Mark Stephen. I suppose all of us at some stage or another have dreamt of living on a desert island as a romance to it, an appeal. Well, June Nelson and her late husband Brian back in the 1960s actually did it. They did it twice, once here in Scotland on an island in the Firth of Forth, and the second time in an area which sounds like a tropical paradise, a veritable Garden of Eden. Of the two, the Scottish island was probably the far easier gig, because life in the Galapagos was extremely difficult. They've written about it in a book called Galapagos Cruzos. It's been a long time since I read anything that captured my imagination quite so much. June nowadays lives down in Cacoubri in Dumfries and Galloway, so I went down to visit her and began by asking her just to describe Brian to me.
He did so many things. He was loved by everybody. He really was an exceptional person. He started off being headhunted by both his English mistress and his biology mistress. Decided that he could write in his spare time, so he would do zoology. Oh, well, he left school at 16 because he wanted to help his parents with funding. Studied for hires at night school. He was incredibly industrious. He was a local preacher. Led the Sunday school. He just worked non-stop. And he used to get up at 4 a.m. to go and look at night jars. He was that sort of a bloke. He just never, ever stopped. But he absolutely loved everything that he did.
How about you? What's your background?
Well, I was much more ordinary. When I met Brian, I was working in a tax office in London. So the difference between us was rather great, except that from about the age of 11, I'd been really interested in birds with my godmother. And I used to go every Sunday morning ringing birds with her. I'd actually ring the gannet before Brian had, because for my 21st birthday, we went to the Farne Islands. And from there, we had a day on the Bass Rock, ringing gannets. So that was quite something to have beaten Brian to that one. So I did have an interest before I met him.
Tell me about the Bass Rock, because, to put it mildly, you had a rather unusual honeymoon in the first couple of years of marriage.
It wasn't quite our honeymoon. We had a honeymoon in the Lake District in January. Brian went off to the Bass Rock to put up a garden shed for us to live in, so I couldn't go. He stayed with the lighthouse keepers, so I couldn't go as soon as we were married. But the minute the shed was ready, I joined him there. And we were 3 years on the Bass Rock. That was for his deep field thesis, Behaviour and Ecology of the Gannet.
I'm smiling because I've read your book and you describe there the garden shed. If you've ever been out in the Bass Rock, you put the garden shed up in the middle of St. Baldred's Chapel, which is a ruin. And, you know, wouldn't give you an awful lot of protection against the howling winds that scream down the Firth of Forth. It must have been freezing.
It was absolutely freezing because we had no insulation. It was purely a wooden garden shed. No insulation on the floor, which was absolutely dreadful because we had sleeping bags. And back in those days, sleeping bags were not what they are today. They were thin, thin. We had really thin blankets. And we had to sleep head to tail because the hut was so narrow, there wasn't room for us side by side. So we couldn't even keep each other warm in that terrible spot. And the wind wind used to howl through the huge east window and go round and round and round inside the chapel. So lighthouse keepers helped Brian to put it up, and he knew what it was going to be like in there, so he insisted we had wire hoses over the roof. That didn't stop it swaying, though, and a rotten egg came off the shelf during a really bad gale and splattered its contents all over.
So you're on the Bass Rock, you know, the Northern Lighthouse Board have got control of the lighthouse there. How did you get backwards and forwards? How did supplies come in? How did you keep yourselves going?
Well, we didn't really go backwards and forwards. We went on in February. We came off in July because my godmother was going for an operation and I wanted to be with her. And then we came off again in November. So that was our only on and off. But there was a wonderful boatman in North Berwick who was the official boatman for the Bass Rock.
Freddie Moore.
Freddie Moore!
Oh, I met him once.
Oh, he was absolutely lovely. He used to bring us mackerel and crabs and very occasionally a lobster. And twice took us off for a picnic, which was absolutely wonderful. And he and Joan came onto the Bass and had a meal with us.
What were you actually doing on the Rock, other than trying to keep the shed in St. Baldred's Chapel?
We were studying the behaviour and ecology of the gannet. So we were doing things like, basic things like weighing, measuring, ringing. But then also we had to study their behaviour, so we had this drafty, drafty hide where we could hardly keep our binoculars steady in the gale, and we were just noting every possible aspect of their behaviour.
Gannet behaviour is actually quite ritualistic. Did you have a sort of shorthand for certain types of behaviour?
Yes, we did. Yes, we had shorthand, and often Brian would dictate to me and I would just jot down initials. RHS was rotary head shake, and B for bowing, that sort of thing.
Sky pointing, bill fencing.
Oh gosh, you're a gannet expert.
No, I wish I was. But I tell you, you go into the Bass Rock nowadays, we were there a couple of years ago, there is not an available square inch. What was it like back in the 60s?
Oh, back then it was quite astonishing. There had been sheep on the Bass Rock, rabbits, puffins in the rabbit burrows, vast amount of grass on the top, and lots of herring gulls nesting, lots of other birds. No, it's virtually solid gannets, apart from the bit where the still visitors are allowed, and they're allowed up as far as where our hut was, and that's the limit. Before, when there were lighthouse keepers on, they used to have to go up to check the foghorn. So that meant that the gannets on that section of the rock were regularly disturbed, so they couldn't nest on the path in that section there. But even whilst we were there, they were encroaching steadily. They were just really round the cliffs, just the top bit of the cliffs and down the steep sides when we first went on.
I went onto the Bass Rock with my old friend and colleague Ewan, who's smaller than me, so theoretically I should be the bigger target. I should be the one that the birds go for, and the birds always, doesn't matter what species it is, they always but always attack him. Gannets are seriously territorial. I mean, did it ever cause you a problem?
We were forever being pecked and scratched and lacerated. Brian had a very impressive scar down his cheek, which when he went to a conference in Austria, they thought was a duelling scar. If you trapped a gannet between you and the cliff edge, you were in for trouble. I just went straight out, and if you were in the way, tough.
How do you go about capturing an adult or even a juvenile gannet in order to ring it?
Well, juveniles weren't too bad. You just have to get them by the back of the neck. Distract them at the front end and then grab them by the back of the neck. But to actually catch an adult, he had to use a noose, which sounds horribly cruel, but in fact they've got necks like horses, so you can't really damage them. But trying to get a noose over a gannet's fiercely jabbing beak in a gale is quite something. Took us a lot of patience.
I mean, a gannet's beak, it's a bit like a sort of 4-inch dagger.
Yeah, it is. It is. It really is. You have to be quite lightning to beat a gannet.
I smiled when I read a piece in which Brian had said that when he was younger, he said, "I'm never going to get married because I'll never find anybody who is prepared to do the kind of things that I want to do." But you did.
Yes, that was absolutely right. He was going to live in a hut on Spurn Peninsula and spend his life studying birds and writing books. No time for women. But then when he met me at Spurn Point, and I seemed quite prepared to do dopey things and shelter on the tables and drive on his motorbike from St Andrews to Yorkshire and such crazy things, he changed his mind.
How did you get from the Bass Rock to the Galapagos?
Well, as a condition of having 3 years on the Bass Rock, we needed an extra year's grant because Brian had wasted a year studying blackbirds in the Botanic Gardens. That really just wasn't him. And in the end, his supervisor agreed he wasn't going to get enough information for a thesis on that study. So he was given a grant for the necessary time, provided he did an extra year on some related topic. And a related topic was obviously the gannet's cousins, the boobies. And the boobies nest only in the tropics. So we were very joyful when we heard that news. Here we had an excuse to go to very exciting, warm places. What a difference to the West Rock. First of all, we had to write by airmail letter. We didn't know Spanish, so we sent off airmail letters in English. It was no wonder at all. We got no replies whatsoever. So the Galapagos are off the coast of South America in the Pacific, about 600 miles off the coast of Ecuador. They actually belong to Ecuador. Fairly calm seas. We wouldn't have managed to get out in the terrible, it had been an American landing barge on which they'd built a superstructure for passengers. So it rolled quite horribly, and it was quite rolling sea, so it was a very unpleasant. I think we were about 6 days getting out there. It was very unpleasant. So we had to go out without getting no replies to whether we could go there, what food we could get, how long we could stay, when the boat went. We were very gung-ho in those days, and we just trusted that everything would be fine, and we were incredibly lucky.
This is the early 1960s. I mean, nowadays, if you go to the Galapagos, it's a tourist destination, essentially. Cruise ships stop there all the time for obvious reasons. Did you know how long you were going to be in one particular location? How did you go up provisioning? Where did you find the stuff?
Well, we knew we wanted to go for a year. We had a year's grant. We knew the two islands that we wanted to work on. Back then, we called them Tower and Hood, but their proper name is Genovesa and Española. One was in the north of the archipelago, one was in the south. So that meant we had to take food for a year. We'd no idea what food, because we hadn't got replies, we'd no idea what food we could get out there. We assumed that there were just four of the Galapagos were occupied, so we suspected they perhaps wouldn't have very good supplies of food, and they wouldn't want researchers coming in and buying up all their supplies. In fact, I think we could have bought much more on the islands than we did. But we couldn't just go out there hoping. So we started off thinking, how can we take enough food for a year? Well, we'd had food on the Bass Rock had been delivered by the lighthouse boats once a fortnight. So I thought, well, if we multiply by 26, we might have enough food. But then we realised that an awful lot of the food we got was fresh, and there was no way we were going to get fresh on the Galapagos. We knew a lot of the things that we'd had on the Bass, dried things that we could take. But back in the 60s, tinned and dried food was very basic. There's only one place to land on Tower Island, and that's a little coral beach at the head of Darwin Bay, which is a tipped volcano about a mile across. And there was just one small strip of coral and lava where we could put our tent, and behind that a lagoon. That was the only campsite, and we pitched our tents there. During the Alaska earthquake, the tide actually ran between our living tent and our store tent. So I think fairly soon that campsite probably isn't going to be viable anymore with climate change. But it was an idyllic spot. With the sea in front for a slightly cooler swim and the lagoon behind for a beautiful warm swim. The lagoon was emptied and filled with each tide, so it was sort of brackish water. I had to do our clothes washing in there with seawater soap, which was totally revolting. Absolutely awful stuff. So we decided it was much better to go without clothes, then we wouldn't have to have these clammy, salty clothes on us.
So you're wondering about the dingle dangle. Presumably Brian's doing the same thing.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Or did he work to higher standards?
Well, Brian drew the line at wearing shoes and nothing else. And because it was lava, we just couldn't walk around barefoot. So if we went on an expedition, he looked quite like the country gentleman going out for a country walk with smart shorts to start with. That didn't last very long. I would have a scarf around my shoulders so I didn't get sunburnt, and I'd have to have boots. So Brian thought that was just terrible, a scarf and boots and nothing else. Just occasionally a yacht would come into the bay, which gave us a mighty shock.
Scamper for the shorts, whatever they are. Yeah, that's
it. Well, we were very wary about visitors, but in the end we decided really they were quite a good thing. The first ones we really didn't want at all. It was just spoiling our idyllic desert island, but they were really rather nice. There were yachtsmen going around the world, mostly. But the first night, a fishing boat came in, and they anchored off our beach each night for quite some time, which really we were quite fed up about. We were a bit frightened of them to start with, because they looked quite a villainous crew. They were very poor. They had ragged clothes and
this is coming from a woman wearing a pair of boots and a scarf.
No, we were dressed at that point. And they used to gut their catch when they got back in the evening, throw the guts overboard. The bay was boiling with sharks. And then the fishermen used to dive overboard. It's quite amazing. The Galapagos creatures are incredibly trusting. Seems that it applies to the sharks as well. They didn't attack at all. Nobody in the Galapagos was attacked by a shark. Even the sharks that in other places do, in fact, attack people.
It's quite extraordinary. I mean, you mentioned the fact that you had the lagoon one side and the sea and the other. It's all salt water. You're on an island with no potable fresh water. So where did you get the water from?
Well, we had to take water. We were incredibly lucky on the way across to South America. We met this incredible doctor who owned the best clinic in Guayaquil. His grandfather had been a British sea captain, so he adopted us, and he was quite astonishing. He gave us so much, including great big water carriers. So we took out water, but they were in these plastic carriers, and it tended to go sort of greenish and not very pleasant tasting. So we did take out the wherewithal to make a solar still. We used driftwood to make the frame for it. We'd taken out something called mylar, which is a sort of see-through, a bit like glass, but it's bendable. And we made like a greenhouse roof over a pit in the sand lined with black polythene. And we turned over the bottom edges of the mylar to form troughs, and then we had collecting cans at the bottom, and then we had to make it water vapor tight, the whole structure. Took us a wee while to perfect it.
If you obviously needed fresh water, there must have been other species on the island that needed fresh water too. Things must have been really desperate for any source of liquid.
Oh, they were totally. There were cacti, which has liquid in there. If there was the slightest rain and there were anything collected in the gap between a tree and a leaf, they would be drinking that. We had a tame finch that used to ask us for water. A lot of the birds just drank seawater and excreted the salt. They are adapted for living in places like that.
Yeah, it is extraordinary. And going back to your solar still, you're putting salt water in, letting, basically, as the name suggests, letting the sun evaporate the water and what have you, and the salt itself is getting brinier and brinier and brinier down at the bottom, but you're actually getting fresh, drinkable water out the side. It can produce quite a lot.
Yeah, absolutely, they can. I think we got about a pint the first few days. We did better than that other days. We did very much worse than that when the small crabs started eating the polythene underneath and the thing leaked. So annoying. And of course we did have relief boats. They brought us out fresh supplies. Oh, the joy of relief day. And they also brought us more water. So it wasn't as though we had to go 6 months on the one supply of polythene water or on the still.
When you were on the Galapagos, what species, I mean, you mentioned boobies, but what species were you working with? What were you actually doing with them? The same as on the Bass Rock?
Well, with the boobies, it was the same as on the Bass Rock, because we were doing a comparative study. And that was absolutely fascinating, because here were birds related to the gannet, but massively smaller, quite brightly coloured, behaving. Well, you could see the similarities, but you could see why they were behaving differently. And gannets had to be aggressive because they didn't have much nesting space. They had to be huge because they were in a cold climate and ate enormous fish. So the boobies were light. Gannets could rely on their food supply. Boobies never knew when they were going to get their next meal. It just needed a Niño year, which is when the Humboldt current veers, for food suddenly to be really, really short. And their chicks would die in the nest. It was really quite heartbreaking to be out there and see the chaos when the climate changed. Brian couldn't resist studying the frigate birds. They were absolutely fascinating. I think there's still a lot to find out about frigate birds. They have quite a different system to most birds.
They're the ones that they swell the throat pouches.
Oh, yes, the males have these incredible balloons underneath their chins to attract the females. And they just move around. They don't keep the same mate, the same nest. It's a totally different system. And we also were studying the waved albatrosses, which were totally different again. They're really fascinating.
I laughed out loud. You write about going into your tent and trying to seal every possible opening and aperture and trying to make bread and basically being mugged by a flock of mockingbirds.
Oh, yes. On our first island, they were fairly polite than mockingbirds. We just thought they were amusing companions and enjoyed their tricks. I mean, they did try to get into the tent whenever they could. They didn't try to take any water or fat that we had. You'd feel a tug at your slice of bread and they were trying to scrape the fat off it. But it was when we got to the second island, it's a different subspecies of mockingbird, much larger, no manners whatsoever, and they were used to taking spilt oil from the waved albatrosses. So they knew what fat was and they absolutely loved it. So trying to stop them taking fat from our pastry, taking water from our meagre supply, which I'd measured out to make the pastry, sabotaging the bread making, oh, it was quite incredible. So we used to empty the laundry basket. Whenever I wanted to bake, we had to empty the laundry basket and stuff every hole that had a guy rope attached to it. Shut the tent, it was really hot, because of course I had the oven on inside and hot in the tent. And then to have to batten down everything, and still they come squirming in. It was totally impossible.
Yeah.
Brian had a lovely description of when I was bread making and they would land in the flour and flap their wings. The flour would go everywhere and then before they left they would excrete into it as a sort of final.
And this is for you.
How did you... It sounds, you know, to be able to wander about in a state of nature on this deserted island, you know, and the sun is always shining and these, you know, fabulous, friendly, mischievous, entertaining animals. But did you keep well enough, just in terms of general health? Were you both OK?
Well, I'm a healthy peasant, so the whole time, apart from the odd stomachache on the second island where things were getting a bit desperate at the end of the second island. The first island was an idyll. It was beautiful weather. We were new to it. The creatures were trusting. They were quite polite on that island. Everything was absolutely fantastic. We got to our second island. It was in the Humboldt Current, so it was much, much colder. It had lots of mist. Quite often it was impossible for Brian to do his filming. By that time, he was really getting quite low. He never sleeps well, and he used to drive himself the whole time. So he would be working non-stop, not sleeping. He'd be up trying to make sure the sea lions didn't bring down our tent, trying to get rid of the giant centipedes that came, and just generally got really run down. So he had things like boils and mouth ulcers and sores that he got on the main island that festered, headaches, stomachache, you name it, Brian seemed to manage to get it. So he had a bit of a miserable time. As a result, he was much less enthusiastic and it was quite hard for me to stay enthusiastic when it was a cold day and we couldn't swim, we'd lost our goggles. And the food was absolutely awful by then. We had maggots in the flour and beetles in the spaghetti, and we were down to rather poor rations, as we'd had to throw quite a few things away. Things we bought in South America from a ship's chandler's turned out to be either not what we'd ordered or on their last legs. And after a year, of course, I don't know how we expected them to be all that brilliant.
You get to this stage, and you're just about leaving anyway, when the Royal Yacht Britannia comes round the headland. Did you expect them? Did you know they were coming?
Unfortunately, we didn't know. We might have been a very strange sight going to meet them. The new director of the Charles Darwin Research Station from the main island had come out to bring us fresh supplies whilst we were on Española, and he told us that the yacht was scheduled. It was not an official visit, so the Queen never visited the Galapagos. She was really, really sad about that. But Prince Philip and his equerries were doing a bird photography tour around some of the islands, and they were due to come in to Hood because it was famous for blue-footed boobies and waved albatrosses, sea lions. There were lots of things he would be interested in and would like to photograph. So we had had a warning. He really was charming, and the folks who were with him were all interested in wildlife. So the Britannia arrived dead on 8 o'clock. Of course, Royal Navy had to be perfect. They were all, of course, in beautiful tropical kit. By that time, our clothes were decaying and in a terrible state. So they spent four hours ashore. Even albatrosses, who normally would be sunk in lethargy under bushes at that time of day, came out and started displaying. It was quite astonishing. And for the first time in daylight, we saw a giant centipede. It was obviously unusual because the mockingbirds all gathered round and were quite astonished to see this enormous earwig about 12 inches long slithering across their path. It was altogether an absolutely delightful visit. Everything went as we'd hoped, better than hoped. Prince Philip was really interested, asked lots of interesting questions. Was his usual sceptical self. And
Did they invite you on board?
Yes, it was a bit amazing. We'd rather dreaded this because we were so ill-clad, but they, 12 o'clock, and they said, well, would you like to come and have lunch with us? So I was in the strangest garb because, well, first of all, Brian was in the strangest garb because his clothes had literally decayed. So his shorts were patched at the back, and at the front they were covered with bird vomit, spilt fish, albatross oil. They were really, really pretty awful state. We had no shoes. I'd rummaged in a trunk because the only thing I had that seemed even vaguely decent were shorts that were way too short to go on board the Britannia with footmen. I mean, I couldn't appear with such short shorts. So I managed to find ski pants and a black sweater.
Yeah, just what you were expecting, the Galapagos. Yeah.
I'd last worn those on the Queen Elizabeth on our way out when she was hove to in November in a force 11 gale. So, I mean, they were vaguely appropriate then. No, I felt very stupid when they were all in beautiful tropical shorts.
It's lovely they invited you out for lunch, you know, and you hadn't had decent food for a long, long time. I bet you the grub on the Britannia was pretty good. Did you get the chance to enjoy it?
Oh, dear, it was a real shame. It was a very nice meal, obviously. But Prince Philip ate his very, very quickly and then just turned to talk to me. I was on his right-hand side. So, trying to intelligently field his questions, I just didn't have time to think about food, so all this wonderful food appeared, and I was thinking about a conversation, not about the food.
And you can't really turn to the footman at the end and say, could you put this in a bag for me, please?
Or did you?
I don't think the footman had doggy bags. No, not really out there. Would have been rather nice.
Eventually your time in Galapagos came to an end. How has your life been since then together?
Gosh. Phew, since then it's been through very many stages. We went from there to the Peruvian Guano Islands to look at another booby, and we were given lump sucker and cabbage for our Christmas dinner, so I decided that maybe I ought to go to university after that and not get involved in any more of these capers. But of course, once we got back, I changed my mind about that. We went off to see the rest of the boobies. We went to Christmas Island. Then we went to Cape Kidnappers in New Zealand to see the Australasian gannet. Christmas Island, we saw Abbott's booby, and that's the only place in the world where it nests.
I think Brian was the first person to photograph an Abbott's booby, wasn't he?
That's right, yes. They're rather perverse. They nest 100 feet up in trees. Imagine a gannet 100 feet up in trees. But we managed to find one at the top of a cliff, so the tree that we climbed mostly, fortunately, was not 100 feet. We did climb up one that was fairly high, and Brian nailed rungs on the trunk, and we just took it in turns to climb up. It was just a standard. I never liked climbing trees as a child, but this was just all part of the work, so I did it. But I rather stupidly, instead of having a hand on two rungs, just relied on one, and it came away in my hand. So I fell backwards. Typical of our luck, there was a small sapling nearby, and I landed with my back against it and slid quite neatly down this sapling and landed in about the one area of soil in amongst limestone pinnacles. I mean, I could have had a broken back, totally killed. All I had was a burn down my side where I slid down the trunk of this tree.
The story you've told me is an extraordinary adventure. Sadly, Brian passed away a few years ago, but, I mean, your house here in Kirkcudbright, I would say 95% of the images are birds. You have somebody snuck a few photographs of family in there, but it's mostly birds. I mean, birds have really been central to your lives.
Oh, absolutely. And even now, during lockdown, when everything was quiet and I had a new hip, so I was walking about very slowly, I found amazing things about the birds in my garden. I've got about 10 blackbirds now that don't care much about territory. They just come to feed on my patio and in my garden. Nowhere really suitable to nest here. And they do have the odd food fight. But to have 10 male blackbirds at this time of year in such close space is most unusual. And I have a thrush that's bullied horribly by the blackbirds, and it knows that if it comes right by my feet, the blackbirds don't come quite that close, it will get fed. So I think there are an awful lot of things about birds that we're still to find out. That the Galapagos ones were incredibly trusting. I think in Britain, if we were not such hectic people, the wildlife in Britain will be trusting too. We did see that when there were so few cars and no planes and life was slower and more peaceful.
June Nelson.
And that book she wrote with her husband Brian is called Galapagos Crusoes, A Year Alone with the Birds, and it's published by Bratt Guides. Bratt is spelled B-R-A-D-T, Bratt. I just love the idea of somebody trying to make pastry in like 95 degrees heat. Fascinating. Let us know where you listen to this podcast. We know that people actually listen to it all around the world, and it puts a smile on our face when we hear about it. You can email us at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Until the next podcast, I'm Mark Stephen. Thanks for listening.